Hello. 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 God.
It's Ken.
Hello?
Mimi?
Yeah, all right. It's like
Hi.
the time. I hate when please, I beg of you, get on at least 3 minutes earlier. It makes me
Well, I got
You
in
know,
two
it's
minutes earlier.
yeah, okay. You got it. Okay. please get in a little bit earlier so that we can, you know, get our shit together.
Okay.
It's 4:59 now, and it's like I'm busy calling you. Did you forget? Is it this? Is she on? You know, just please, just a little bit when we're this crazed.
Gotcha.
I will also send you. Katia sent me their programming outline. I don't know what they are or aren't doing, but they've got a gazillion hours of time. They've given us our 1 to 3 hours of time. Bill Fletch is doing, you know, anyway, I don't think anything's going to be duplicated at all. I'll send you what their programming out piece looks like. And
okay.
I think most of theirs are going to be interviews, long interviews, like I don't know what the hell Bill Fletcher is going to do, or, you know, I don't care. But I was mostly concerned that things not be duplicated. But I will give that guy Chris a call. But anyway, she just sent me their outline and where we fit into things.
Okay.
So if this thing works with Judy, I've got Judy and Gerald, and that'll be a fabulous program. So that should take care of that.
Okay, so I'll have to cut her down for May Day.
What is there anything in particular you absolutely want to ask her aside from the sick pay?
Well, let's see what she covers, and I'll bounce.
Well, I mean, I'm asking you in advance since you.
I haven't been able to make the transition to think about it.
Okay, done. That's all I want to know. Yeah, I mean, obviously, yeah. We'll see what she says, but I just want them to know if there is anything so that we didn't, kind of intercept and make things harder.
Right.
Okay, so it's 5:01.
Yeah, she said she's going to call in a couple of minutes early, so.
But it's not a couple of minutes early.
I know that, so let's
give it
another
minute. It's a couple of
minutes
late.
Okay.
And I'm just saying because there's two other things I've got to do, so I'm just, and I get nervous when, Here we go.
Hi, this is Judy Sheridan Gonzalez, president of New York State Nurse Association.
Hey, Judy.
President Judy, my God, I'm so sorry to hear about your brother-in-law. That's just, oh, my God, I'm sorry. Wow, did this happen in this country or?
Yeah, in the Bronx.
In the Bronx.
Yeah, COVID. Not unlike many families. Everybody's been touched.
Oh, God knows. Yes, I can't. Yeah, the numbers of people I've lost. And I'm also continuing to work at the legal aid. I'm on duty now. We're on emergency duty. It's so through our health law. My clients are going through hell, including illegal evictions in the context of all of this and the level of discrimination that's now occurring where people they actually want to sue their landlords not to rent out space in a state of hysteria to keep out those people, you know, which reminds me of the crap we went through with the AIDS, HIV epidemic. I mean, there's so many ghastly, terrifying
There's a lot of moving parts here.
Well, thank you so much for, in the midst of all of this, to agreeing to be with us. But I can't think of anybody who can relate the issues more poignantly, educate the public better, and get people on board to support the things that we've been left without that have really exacerbated this terrible virus. So again, just thank you, and you know, my heart goes out to you for everything.
Thank you so much. Okay,
so we can. New York Nurses Union is on the front line of coronavirus outbreak, and now they have sued the state and two hospitals over, quote, war zone, end quote, conditions. We are speaking with Judy Sheridan Gonzalez, and I want to begin with your own description of what the conditions that hospital workers, that healthcare workers have been under, nurses, doctors, orderlies, all the people that make our healthcare facility work, and many of whom are generally not given the kind of credit and acclaim and hero-shiro status that they should be.
Well, I think it's really important to contextualize what's happening with post-COVID entry into our city and our country with what happened prior. We've been suffering as a nation and certainly as a state and a city an inordinate amount of cuts to healthcare. Not that healthcare costs have not gone up. They have gone up tremendously. But the manner in which care has been delivered and the manner in which the cuts take place, they've impacted disproportionately poor communities, working class communities, and communities of color by bed closings, hospital closings, staff cuts, and other elements have been put into place to put us already at a functioning level, which is what we call bare bones, where, you know, there's just not enough time to do what we need to do for our patients. There's not enough space to take care of them. And our patients in those communities in particular are packed together like sardines in emergency departments and are housed in actual hallways up on the units because the hospitals gain much more money by having fewer beds and having these sort of extra spaces where they can charge patients the full admission but really not place them in rooms. You can only imagine in the face of a pandemic that when you already are totally crowded together that way, what that looks like when you have to double your capacity for patients and they're just come pouring in, they're really sick. There's just no way in the world you can even play catch up given the conditions prior. So when the virus hit, or actually prior to the virus hitting, many of us, we do have a union and we do meet with management. Many of us locally tried to meet with our employers, and you know, said, "Listen, let's try to really partner in this, because this could be really bad. Let's talk about how to work together to create an environment in which we can handle this." Now, the biggest problem is the way healthcare is financed. The healthcare system in New York State and in the country is set around making a profit, and it is not profitable to store masks, N95 respirators, elastomeric respirators, PAPRs, all the things that we need to protect ourselves, gowns, ventilators, oxygen masks, all those things in some warehouse when you're not using it. That doesn't make any money, so hospitals don't do it. It's not profitable to have mock codes, mock disaster codes. And when I started in nursing, we had them frequently. But it's not profitable. They call that non-productive time. It's not profitable to have more nurses than you might need in a given day, ready, willing, and able to handle a pandemic. And it's not profitable to have beds open, hospitals open, that may not be at 100% capacity at all times. That completely goes against the way in which healthcare is structured. So the way the healthcare is structured sets us all up to have no capability whatsoever to manage anything more than business as usual, because we can't even handle business as usual. That's the environment in which we enter the COVID crisis.
Well, since you're educating us and contextualizing things, let's talk even a little bit more about the nature of healthcare in this society, whether it is essentially a system of profit and how it's structured to begin with, and how government has been dealing with it as well as the hospital structure so that we have wound up in this incredible crisis.
Well, I mean, again, healthcare is a public good. I mean, everybody would probably agree that it's a public good. We identify it as caregivers, as something that people have a right to. People have a right to have access to get the care that they need to remain healthy. We also have a conception that we share, which we call the social determinants of health. What keeps people healthy is not just the fact that they can go to a facility and get care, which is critical, having access and being able to afford it, but all the different things that put people in jeopardy: lack of nutrition, poor housing, inadequate education, crowding, inadequate leisure space, poverty, racism, sexism, discrimination in all of its forms. These things have an impact in people's what we call comorbidities, conditions, chronic conditions, or even acute conditions that make people much more susceptible to illness. And these are the people who really suffered a lot from the virus because they were unable to sustain an immune response the way other people were, and of course the elderly. And, you know, this is another thing that's really important: the incarcerated, the elderly, those in mental institutions, people in nursing homes, people with disabilities who are homebound, all of the people who are most vulnerable in our society were the people who succumbed initially to the disease and disproportionately are impacted. What happened also with COVID is that because of the nature and the way that the disease is transmitted, healthcare workers disproportionately were impacted or were much more at risk of contracting the disease. And just to go very basic about how people get sick when you have a bacteria or virus or some kind of infectious disease, the principle is the way you get sick, it has to do with the virulence or predominance of the virus or organism and the susceptibility of the host. I just spoke about the susceptibility of the host, people with comorbidities, elderly, the vulnerable. But the virulence of the organism and its overwhelming presence is what happens to healthcare workers. We're confronted with being surrounded by virus, and particularly for people who are very sick, that virus is all over the place. It's when you do a test for COVID, for example, some people had false negatives. The false negative is not that you were negative. It could be that you didn't have enough virus that you would be shedding at the moment in which the test was taken, so it might have looked negative. It doesn't say negative, it says undetectable, because maybe it's so small. So somebody who is asymptomatic, who might be shedding virus, it's maybe in small amounts, but people who are in the ICU, people in the ERs, and people in our medical units, which are now ICU-like units, there's a huge amount of virus, so that's the reason that we get affected more than the public, which is why we needed a protective equipment. The name we use is PPE, protective equipment, which is so important to have to protect us because we're dealing with so much virus in the air, being shedded, being around us, clinging to our clothing, clinging to our bodies, and that is what is responsible for the deaths and high levels of infection that all of us sustain in healthcare.
I just want to take it back also to the issue of government, from the federal government to the state government to our city government. To what extent do you feel that they dealt with the public's lives in such a way that, again, they were putting practical, that they were putting profits before people, and philosophically, ideologically, and systemically, not in any way really concerning about the realization that we have had a series of pandemics on a smaller scale and that another one was likely to occur? Can we assess blame there?
I mean, aside from the way that I described the healthcare system, the way it exists, once you have to play catch-up, you have to move quickly. And, of course, that didn't happen. It wasn't taken seriously. I could do an hour conversation about why that happened. You know, very, very poor response. You could compare us to South Korea, for example, South Korea got the same time they had their first cases as the U.S. They immediately put into action social distancing, mask wearing, testing, more testing, cohorting, looking at contacts, isolating, all that kind of stuff, and protecting the workers as well. So their curve, you know, you talk about flattening the curve, their curve was like a mountain, like a little Mount Everest, went up and then went down, and then they entered a very, very low field in the bell curve. As they reach baseline, they are now considering reducing those kinds of distancing standards and the kind of social things that have to be put into place. The U.S., you know, just it's enormous numbers of people getting ill, very poor response rate, very poor social distancing, not enough access to PPE, everyone getting sick. The percentages of healthcare workers in New York City getting sick, and particularly the poorer communities, you know, those of us who work in poor communities, whether we live there or not, we're the collateral damage of the way that the communities get treated because we have worse conditions. So the infection rate, for example, in my hospital in the Bronx is huge. It's ridiculously high. Thousands and thousands of healthcare workers in my facility have been ill, quite ill, and are testing positive. And that curve, that flattening curve now is just reaching that kind of plateau wiggle. May go up again, go down a little bit, and people are talking about relaxing. People are talking about relaxing standards. It's insane. It's an insane call, and we're definitely going to be dealing with that with our allies in the community, which doesn't discount that people are suffering. I'm very concerned about malnutrition becoming a big issue in the Bronx and in our poor communities right now. So the solution is not to people to give up their lives so they can go back to work. The solution is to have our government and our society and our state to support people so that they continue to be safe and have enough food, housing, and other things that they need to be able to survive until we can get to that bottom of the bell curve. We feel very strongly about that.
Judy Sheridan Gonzalez, I know that you were recently in Puerto Rico, which suffered enormously, of course, from Hurricane Maria. It similarly is still undergoing what they call the junta, which is just an enormous amount of hyper-exploitation. Some people would call it kind of fascist rule and consolidation of the economy to actually be a hyper state of imperialism. I wonder if you were there and such that you experienced and could tell us anything about what was also happening on the island and to the people of Puerto Rico relevant to coronavirus.
Well, I think we're very lucky right now. Again, well, we think we're lucky because the testing is terrible. They were it was just like the that scandal for the electrical company. They purchased tests that were totally ineffective that they couldn't use. And so the testing is way behind what it should be. But the social distancing was implemented, and curfews, which sound very scary but probably really helpful, they did that before even the U.S. did. And so far we think the rate is low, but it's very hard to determine the level of positive COVID because of the lack of testing and the adequate testing. The healthcare system is in a shambles in Puerto Rico. Before COVID, even before the earthquake, but since then, it's been worse. Certainly after Hurricane Maria was much worse. And so the other thing is that we have a lot of elderly in Puerto Rico. We have a lot of comorbidities, you know, the diseases of poverty with the worst health indices in U.S. States and territories and colonies. So, you know, very, very vulnerable population and very densely populated. So if COVID hits the island, it will be a total devastation. People are isolated, and that is very hard, very difficult culturally. People are used to, you know, caring for one another in very different ways than we do, I think, in this country. And, you know, it's been a tough survival anyway. So now it's just that tough survival with feeling isolated. So, but we're fortunate right now, at least to the best of our knowledge, it's not what it's like in the United States.
The New York State Nurses Association filed suit just recently against the state and two hospital systems, alleging dangerous conditions that put healthcare workers at risk and inflamed the country's largest coronavirus outbreak. Can you talk about that?
Well, unfortunately, I just heard that we have a sort of, I don't know if you call it a gag order. We can't share. I was in Zoom court all day, which is quite an experience. So I can't share the discussions that we had, but basically what's in the lawsuit, which is in the public domain, and certainly what nurses have been talking about, are the basis, you know, we sued two hospitals, one public, one private, and the Department of Health, which is the state of New York, really, regarding the protections that we think were not in place for the frontline caregivers, including nurses, and other caregivers. Wanting a different type of protection. One of the things, for example, that we have found would be much more useful is a mask called an elastomeric mask. It looks a little bit like a gas mask. It's not that expensive. It's much more comfortable. I'm not sure if people have seen the pictures of what we look like when we wear those N95s all day with the scars and cuts and bruises and rashes and disfigured. We have disfigured faces. From these masks, they're not designed to be worn all day. But initially, I mean, each step of the way, everyone has had to fight for things. Initially, nurses were very, and nurses and others were told, don't even wear a surgical mask as this started to roll out. We had to fight to be able to wear surgical masks. Then when we were treating patients, COVID-positive patients or presumptive positive patients, we had to fight for N95s. We were told that, the CDC's guidelines are you don't have to wear an N95. An N95 protects you against airborne infection, and it's a kind of continuum, this concept of droplet and airborne. It's the size of the organism and how long it sits in the air. I mean, I don't know if anyone ever attached a monitor to the droplet to see where it sits and where it goes, but clearly this is a very infectious microorganism, and the CDC initially had guidelines built around having to wear those N95 respirators, which supposedly disallow 95% of organisms in the air to enter your nasal and oral passages. And then they relaxed the guidelines. March 10th, I think it was, they said, well, we're relaxing the guidelines. We don't really need those. It's not really airborne. And, of course, the hospitals seized on that to just be very lax in providing N95. Initially in my own hospital and in many hospitals, particularly those without unions, people were threatened with termination for using an N95 mask if they were able to get a hold of one, quote-unquote inappropriately, which meant pretty much most of the time, unless you were doing certain procedures. We fought back. That they had to change that. You know, everything that we got in terms of protecting ourselves was a fight in all of the facilities. Everything was a fight. How often you got the mask, how often you had to use it, if you had to change it. Where you would change into better clothing, where you take them off, where you could avoid infection, gowns, head shields, face shields, head wraps, foot wraps, Tyvexes, anything that we could. We all became epidemiologist experts in trying to figure out what is the best thing to protect us, and it's not where it needs to be in any one particular place. In addition, the hours worked. In China, in the second phase of Wuhan, after so many people died and got sick, including health workers, they had a different strategy. It was using this extraordinarily protective equipment, kind of like a spacesuit, but the staff would work four-hour shifts. You wouldn't go to the bathroom, you wouldn't eat, you wouldn't drink during that 4 hours, but you were totally protected, so you could spend time with patients. People may not be aware that what nurses do, what's most important is the time we spend with our patients. What do we do in that time, aside from medicating and treating and caring for patients, we're able to monitor deterioration or potential complications. We are now told don't spend time in the room, and for good reason, because it's sort of an admission we're not protected, right? They said don't go in the room unless you have to. Well, because they know we're not protected. But if we were protected, we could spend much more time with patients, and we'd have fewer patients dying alone, you know, or spending their last moments in that state or suffering bad outcomes. The outcomes when you're protected are much better because you're able to spend more time with the patients. So it's a win-win all around to provide that protection. But in the United States, it hasn't happened except for very rare circumstances in very few facilities or in specific areas in other facilities. And that's an ongoing fight, particularly because this we may get a second phase of this or it may worsen if the country is as silly as it's being right now and loosening the requirements to isolate. And or a next pandemic. This is not the last pandemic that we'll see, I don't believe.
The New York State Nurses Association, the union, represents 42,000 nurses across New York. And I understand there's a gag order, but I'm just particularly interested in what was the malfeasance, the negligence, the neglect that you allege in any event against the particular, you are the plaintiffs in the suit, which was filed in New York State Supreme Court. How did you pick the petitioners that you filed against, and were they just outright recalcitrant, or is this a matter of economic deprivation? Can you talk about that? Pity the poor hospitals. What are we to do? We don't have the economic wherewithal to give the protections that we would like to our nursing staff, and also the severity of the virus and our general societal unpreparedness means that in terms of hours and other conditions, what are we to do? How are we supposed to deal with sick pay and various other things? Oh, pity the downtrodden hospital operators.
I think there were some particularly recalcitrant players. I think that certainly went into the thinking about the suits. I think that, again, we were failed by the CDC. We were failed by a lot of the government agencies and government itself, but hospitals could have risen to the occasion. They didn't have to say, oh, the CDC changed their guidelines. That's good. That's all we have to do. They could have, and some did say, you know, we're going to do more than that. We're going to do better than that. We really will go out of our way to see what we can do. Yes, there was scarcity, but we found in the face of scarcity, nurses were many of our nurses are buying their own protective equipment on Amazon, on eBay, going through sources in China. My own son started a GoFundMe page and was able to procure thousands of N95s of good quality that we started distributing. So the hospitals couldn't do that. You know, it's kind of weird, right? I have nurses that spend up to $1,000 of their own money on equipment just because they were so terrified of dying. That's crazy that they're able to do that. Yes, I know buying in bulk is difficult, but start somewhere. Start somewhere. Start accumulating. We're talking about something that was clearly a big problem, you know, nearly 2 months ago. I mean, I think it was pretty obvious in early March that this was very serious. Why didn't stuff start happening then, even if it wasn't available? We also focused on the federal government and the state government to implement.
Yeah,
on
I was
the federal
going to
level.
Ask you that, if yeah. I may. And I, by the way, misspoke, and I said petitioners before. We're talking about the defendants in that context. And yeah, the union also filed suit against Montefiore Medical Center System in Manhattan Federal Court on behalf of 3,000 registered nurses, and also the Westchester Medical Center in Westchester County Supreme Court. I'm curious about prompted the federal court action and where that stands as well, which you were just beginning to.
Are you talking about the Department of Health? Are you talking about the Department of Health case?
Yeah.
I mean, I want to put it in the context of what is the role of government in protecting its society. You know, it's like a double standard, you know, in this country, it's like if it's war, you know, war, guns, ammunition, bomb, war, all systems go. You know, you can do anything. But when we have other situations that really threaten the public, you know, look at Homeland. What is Homeland Security? You know, we're in the homeland and we're insecure. You know, what's being done on that level? In World War II, for example, and this is why we demanded that the federal government really implement the Defense Production Act, in World War II, factories were mandated, and they fought back. But the government mandated factories to produce weapons for war and protections for soldiers who went to war. That was what we wanted done immediately in this crisis, that the federal government would mandate through the Defense Production Act, which was actually introduced during the Korean War, that factories would create and produce respirators, ventilators. And respirators, I mean the things that you wear. Ventilators are the machines that people are hooked up to breathe. And other kinds of equipment, gowns, to protect workers. Under pressure, President Trump said, yeah, he would do that, but really didn't implement it, you know, kind of let the market rule. Well, the market is the reason that we're dying. The market's the fault. The healthcare system ruled by the market and industry ruled by, you know, all this market stuff is what's killing us. You know, there should have been a mandate. Same thing with the state. You know, businesses should be mandated. There have been some efforts to do that. A lot of the efforts that have been done are very too little, too late, and only the result of organizing, protesting, and workers and community people, you know, fighting back against these conditions.
I'm just wondering if, aside from the issue, which obviously is critical, of the PPEs and the protection, what are other things that you relate to and the relief that you sought in these respective suits? Does some of it also have to do with demanding a voice and that there be a listening session, that the healthcare providers be at the table to work through protocols for servicing and protecting the patients?
So just to sort of emphasize, the lawsuits were sort of a last-ditch effort, an adjunctive effort to get the things that we needed that we shouldn't have had to file lawsuits. All of the workers in these hospitals, you know, approached management, all of the nurses said, let's figure this out. We think people are going to have to be redeployed. Let's start training people because where are we going to need people? Let's look at China. ICUs, medical units for people who are not, you know, near death's door. What kind of training is going to be needed? People who are working in elective surgery, let's cancel the elective surgery. Let's quickly train people in ways that they can be more more adept in working in these units. You know, it's not a nurse is a nurse is a nurse. We have specialties as well. People who work in the OR, it's a totally different world than working in a direct care unit. People who are nurse practitioners working in primary care, totally different than working inside in acute care. And people are also very highly specialized, whether it's oncology or neurosurgery and so forth. So, you know, there was a need for training. There was a need to take a look at, will people have to now change their shifts? Will people have to change their hours? Will, you know, what do we do with our families? We're going to be essential workers. What happens to our children? What happens to housing? Everything we wanted to talk about initially, and everything wasn't done quickly enough, and everything was built, you know, when they saw people sleeping in their cars, okay, we'll get the hotels so you don't go home. We have people still who haven't seen their children, who haven't seen their elderly parents in nearly 2 months because they're afraid of infecting them because we're not protected against infection, and that's a big issue. We wanted to talk about the protective equipment, about the space, what it would look like. Let's talk together. Let's figure it out. Let's work together. But, you know, that's not kind of the way that a lot of employers function. They want to tell you what to do, and they think that they know best, and they really don't take your opinions into account. So that's been a big frustration for a lot of us. And then, of course, threatening. When people are trying to just protect themselves or say, you know, I can't do this. This is not possible. You know, I feel sick. You know, initially being pressured to come back to work before you were well, not being paid that 14-day, you know, executive order that we should get 14 days off if we get ill, people, you know, not being paid out of that bundle or out of that. It was a guideline that it wouldn't come out of your benefit time, that you would be paid 14 sick days that would be free of charge to what you had banked in your benefit time. That wasn't being implemented across the board at all, and that was another issue. So being pushed back to work when you're sick, you know, not getting the pay that way, everything was a fight, everything was a fight, everything was a fight.
So the lawsuits, I know, call out Governor Andrew Cuomo's administration and the hospitals for failing to supply nurses with masks and gowns. And according to the executive director of NYSNR, Pat Kane, she said that 70% of the nurses reported being exposed to the dangerous disease and that most are still untested. Now, what is the next step with this litigation? And then I want to do something, if I may. And that is, we are broadcasting this in proximity to, it's May Day. It's May Day. History of militants of the working class. Now, if you were speaking at a rally, and let's pretend that we are, of hundreds of thousands of workers in this country and workers of the world uniting, where does this take us? What does this demonstrate? What are the issues that and demands that need to be brought up in a societal context to protect the working class? You, the workers, the nurses, the healthcare providers, and the broader populace of workers, many of whom are clearly cannon fodder for the profits of their employers. And I have to say that, for example, Trump has just said that under no condition would he permit the poultry and the meat processing plants to in any way shut down appropriately or what have you to contain the coronavirus, which has impacted on their workforce, which are tens upon tens of thousands of people. So I know that's a big mouthful. But let's take you to that podium and kind of give us a sense of where you go with the lawsuit, the next steps then, and where you go as somebody who is a conscious union leader about the conditions that we, the working class, face in this country.
Well, you know, I think with this pandemic illustrates best is how terribly, terribly inadequate the systems that are in place to support human beings in this society are. We have such savage inequities in our society. The difference between the very rich and everyone else is huge. It's humongous. It's similar to medieval times. And what happens in a situation like this, it's stripped naked. So we see sort of the naked reality of how horrible life is for most people. People are living on the edge. People are living paycheck to paycheck if they're lucky to have a paycheck. People are just hanging on by a thread to begin with. And then when you cut that thread, there's nothing left. And so healthcare, it's most obvious. Obviously, we need a different healthcare system. We need a national health system that provides healthcare for everyone, that doesn't discriminate, that doesn't allow poor people or people of color or people who are working class people to have inferior care, poor access, go bankrupt. That's the first thing. But we also see it in our educational system and housing everywhere. You know, this is something that should be a wake-up call for all of us, that we really need system transformation on many levels, whether it revolves around climate, discrimination, all the different things that have value in our lives. You know, we have enough resources and wealth in this country for everyone to have a much better quality of life. But, you know, the way that the taxation has worked, I mean, one of the demands that we're making, and we're making in conjunction with other unions, community groups, and several of our politicians in New York State, is to change the tax codes. If we tax the super rich and corporations the way we did 40 years ago or even 30 years ago, we wouldn't even have a deficit. But we enter this pandemic in a background of serious and draconian cuts to healthcare from the federal government and the state government. That gives you a non-sustainable system to begin with, and it becomes a nightmare, the nightmare that we're living right now. So I, as workers, as labor, as unions, as communities, together, united, we've got to demand that things change. This is the moment in time in which I don't want anyone to ever forget what it's like to be stuck in your house with a mask on when you go anywhere, to go nowhere, to have no job, to have relatives dropping like flies, to have health workers dropping like flies, transit workers, so-called essential workers who really are considered expendable. Being a hero doesn't mean you have to be a martyr. And being a bona fide resident of a community should give you some kind of rights to, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? We don't have that. And this is a time for us to really wake up and recognize that we deserve better, we can do better, and the only way we're going to get it is to fight. You don't win this in courts, even though we did file a lawsuit. You really win it in the streets, and I guess the virtual streets now. I don't know what we call the streets anymore. But we've got to understand that a kinder, gentler nation, state and city is possible. We've seen it with the 7 o'clock supports that people give us. It's very, very meaningful to us. All the donations, all the help, all the support. It's the people that are keeping us going, and the people can do a lot more. Let's recognize that beauty that we have in us, the love that we have in us, and let's build a better nation with that.
And just lastly, President Judy Sheridan Gonzalez of the New York State Nurses, New York State Nurses Association, how are you holding up? Aside from the work that you do, I know that you have just lost your brother-in-law, a dear member of your family in the Bronx to COVID-19. How are you doing?
You know, it's very hard.
Yeah.
Very hard. You know, one of the things, aside from our own personal family issues, and that everybody's going through that, as caregivers, not being able to take care of patients who need us for the reasons that I discussed, not having the staffing. I mean, we were poorly staffed before, but when you're in an ICU, for example, and you know that you can only save one or two patients at a time, being told you're now going to be taking a 4 and 5, or you're in a medical unit where you know you can take care of 4 or 5, and you're being told you have to take care of 10 or 12, you're triaging your care. And that takes a toll on you that you're not supposed to do any harm. And when, by virtue of accepting an assignment like that, you know you're going to be doing harm. And that's what's destroying us. I mean, you're hearing about these suicides. I've talked to several nurses who have been suicidal and other healthcare workers. And that emotional and mental anguish that you experience in confronting something like this is just devastating.
Judy Sheridan Gonzalez, you have our support, you have our love and gratitude forever for what you and your colleagues do now and what you have always done. The New York State Nurses Association have lent themselves to the cause, disaster after disaster, from Hurricane Maria to Hurricane Sandy and so many other things. They are the frontline responders. They are selfless. They are committed, regardless of their own really apocalyptic circumstances. Thank you for joining us, Judy.
Sure. Can I just end by saying
sure,
that we really do care about our community. It's not just about us. You know, we care about our sisters and brothers who are also essential workers who are less fortunate in some ways. Our food delivery workers, our warehouse workers, our delivery people, our transit workers who are dying at really high numbers because they don't have the protection either. Our communities that are starving. That are suffering so much. It's all important to us. It's not just, we're not the only people who are important to us. We care about everyone.
You sure do. Judy, thank you. Thank
sure,
you for
welcome.
All that you do. Thank you for speaking to us, and stay strong and stay well. And I'm very grateful that you spent the time with us.
Okay. Thank you so much. Bye.
Take care.
Thank you, Judy. That was wonderful.
And we're speaking now with Judy Sheridan Gonzalez about the New York City Hospital's struggle with life or death. Wow. Let me just say that again. I'm speaking with, and now, New York City Hospital's struggle with life or death. We speak with Judy Sheridan Gonzalez, an emergency room nurse at Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx, and who heads the New York State Nurses Association. Whoa.
And did you do an outro?
I've been speaking with Judy Sheridan Gonzalez, an emergency room nurse at Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx and the head of the New York State and the head of the New York State Nurses Association. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Very good. I don't know what to do with it, but...
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure as hell going to let it, you know, go 35, 40 minutes, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, it was about a little over 40.
Yeah. Which is fine for me.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
How are we going to work this forth? May Day is another question, but... Yeah.
Well, some of the, you know, I mean, we don't need the Puerto Rico question particularly in there, although, frankly, I think it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'd love to keep it, but...
Yeah, me too. And what did I miss, Ken?
Not much. It was beautiful. I mean, you know, it was beautiful.
Yeah. Including, and I don't know if you fully grasp this, you probably, I don't assume you have an N95 mask. I do. And I can't tell you what this means. When she was talking about those pictures we've seen of people with, you know, the kind of cuts and, you know, rivets in their face and stuff when they've been wearing those masks for any period of time, they really are painful and stuff. I have one of those masks, which I happened to get when I went into a mask, and it was the only one they had. And it's after 15 minutes of wearing it, it cuts deep into your skin, aside from your breathing and all the rest of it. But physically, it absolutely is the metal, you know, digs into your skin and stuff. And it's like if when I wear it to go out shopping or whatnot, it's like miserable. And I've seen some of the photographs. I've seen what I look like when I take it off, but I've seen some of the photographs of the medical staff who've worn these things, you know, for 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 hours at a time. And it's just vivid. It really physically is enormously painful. And just even her description of that. But I knew she could do what she does, which is, yeah, she really is a real old lefty. And, you know, just picks up on this stuff. She didn't have to say, you know, Medicare for all, although, you know, she did. And she just has it all, you know. She understands
yeah, so
the
she
working
really
class.
Does, so.
And she starts to begin with before you even ask her. Or, you know, she contextualizes it. It's not just like it sprang, you know, Athena springing from the head of Zeus. It happens in a context. And I must say, I'm fucking pissed. What the fuck have they got a gag order for? I mean, gag orders are very, very dramatic and severe at things. It's like, well, what? So a judge decided that, what, this would somehow undermine the society that the healthcare professionals were forced to sue? I just can't even imagine. You know, it's very rare. Judges don't want things litigated in the, particularly in the court of public opinion, although they always are, and that's the suit to begin with, that, you know, the courts are the public vehicle, among others, for its litigation. But the idea of a fucking gag order on this, you have gag orders when, like, you know, there's a mafia case, etc., and you talk about it, somebody's going to lose their life, or when somebody like Roger Stone is, you know, really trying to warp and slant public opinion and actually putting the case in danger by, so you, you know, say shut up, you know, and he didn't shut up, and then they wanted to hold him in contempt, which he got off very easily on. But I'm just like, what the fuck, in a public health emergency? The judge, I'm curious, I didn't ask which judge she's in front of, shit. Well, I'll find out easily enough, through. But I just, yeah, and the last piece, you know, which I had to ask, because it's just another... This isn't just this is their lives. I mean, they're very, nurses are not, most of them are really community, they're community people, you know. They're hardly, you know, the hierarchy of, you know, the workers and little people. And so they're, you know, she works in Montefiore in the Bronx. And I wonder if her brother-in-law died in the same hospital she works in. And she also mentioned something else that I thought was enormously interesting and important, and that is that despite all this stuff about how the nurses, they hang with the patients, they hang with the patients, saying, well, the fact of the matter is we're not allowed to hang with the patients.
Right.
That folks
right.
are alone and dying. They won't let us. You know, I just think she painted by far the most, notwithstanding hours of Rachel Maddow and all these other things, and our discussions with Deborah Berger, I just think she painted a social picture of who these people are, of the work they do, of the coronavirus, and of the circumstances of the working class. Well, not just a backdrop to this, and right. then her own personal life, i.e. the loss of her brother-in-law. And it was today or yesterday. Damn. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just like kind of overwhelmed right. by her.
Yeah, she was great. She was wonderful.
Yeah, I'll send her an email for us.
Okay.
All right, so we're on at 6:30.
Right.
Gerald's going to be on at 7:30.
Okay, that's good.
And let's just for the moment, have you had any chance to think at all about Poland stuff, or where you want to go with that?
Well, I think criticism of what has happened so far in terms of the federal response, and then talk about the transition and the Green New Deal.
I'm sorry. It's a little garbled. Can you say that again, please?
A criticism of the response so far by the federal government in terms of how it's been geared
towards
COVID-19.
Response to what? Response
COVID,
to what?
COVID-19.
Do we really need him talking about the response of the federal government?
Well,
I mean, he's not
just to begin the process, that wouldn't be very long. And then what's happening now in the transition, especially the transition in jobs in terms of the Green New Deal, which is where he, you know, obviously.
Don't you think, because
that.
Otherwise we're going to wind up running over and getting crazy. I don't think we don't need him to comment on the federal government's response to COVID. I think we need him to start from the point of view that they are starting to and want to open up the economy.
All right, let's
at a time when
there.
We have 23 million.
Okay, let's start from there then. Fine. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I don't need him to comment on Trump's insanity.
Right.
And what else do you particularly... grabs you about what you'd like to
well, that's
ask him.
In the forefront of my mind right now.
Okay.
The transition.
Okay. Okay. I tell me if you think this is out of it, but I'm still just enormously distressed, and I don't understand, and I don't know where the Green New Deal has much of anything to do with this. And that is, you have 23 million people that, you know, have applied for unemployment. And Lord knows what the number of people are otherwise who've lost their livelihood. So as far as I'm concerned, it's depression level and more. But I don't see anybody at all talking about the provision. And I don't see, between you and I don't see what the Green New Deal really has to do with what is going to be the most important thing now, which is, what are you going to do with 23 million plus people who have lost their livelihood, many, if not most, in hospitality and other industry, et cetera, where they are not in any way going to be, aside from the pandemic itself continuing, and some states being smarter than others, there is no way these people are going to be employed in any immediate time. And what does the Green New Deal really have to do with what are we going to do with these people? Isn't it really much more about talking about a new deal? Isn't that really more where we should be? I mean, I'm talking about
the Green New Deal is part of the New Deal. I wasn't saying it's the whole thing.
No, but it has nothing to do with putting people back to work.
No, it does have to do with people being put back to work.
No.
Yes, he does talk about short-term and long-term stuff, but also, yeah.
90% of those people who have lost their jobs have no capacity, no skill. They're jobs for younger people, for the most part. More of them than not are for men. Most of them require a significant period of training. And
well, that's why I had short-term and long-term stuff on the Green New Deal. It's part of the solution. It's the whole thing.
Okay. I don't see it. Everything I've read was never structured for people who need to have a livelihood quickly, who have suddenly, without any, you know, we've been driven from whatever the percentage of employment unemployment was to, like, what, depression? And I just don't see that the precepts of the Green New Deal. I'm not fighting against the Green New Deal. But
well,
let's
do it first. Separate the thing first. Say, like, I mean, aside from the Green New Deal, what should be done? And then we'll put the Green New Deal at the end.
Okay. Okay.
All right?
Yeah,
okay.
And I don't know if he has any capacity to deal with that or anything, but it's just rather striking to me. Somebody better start figuring out, because the soup kitchen lines are really serious and
gotcha,
growing.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Gotcha. All right, let me hang up first and then make sure I got this thing, and then
yes,
prepare
please
for the next interview, okay?
Yep.
I'm going to hang up first, right?
I'm sorry,
online.
What?
I'm going to hang up first. Stay online.
Yes, I am.